Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to the last spooky season podcast of 2023.
Yeah.
There'll probably be more horror, but we will probably all will go over a little bit next week. And
right. We'll have to report on whatever we watch in the final week.
And it will be actually, next Tuesday when we record, it'll be Halloween.
Yeah.
It will be the spookiest. I lied.
Yeah, there's
this
one more week.
This is but the penultimate spooky season.
So people should probably avoid the next podcast because it's going to be the spookiest thing ever and they'll probably die.
There will be jump scares.
There'll be jump scares.
We're just going to be driving along and randomly one of us will scream.
So, all of us have at some point done some of the spooky fiction podcasts.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Not too many of them have jump scares, but have you ever had it where there is like something, some jarring sound or whatever?
Yeah.
It's pretty alarming when you're doing it in a podcast.
Yes.
And also like, because you might be like driving or something that, that's a little extra alarming.
Yeah.
I don't generally like it when they do it. They don't do it too often. But Nick, that left-right game had some crash sound effects in it.
That's not cool.
And they do warn you in the beginning. They're like, there's some realistic sound effects. But they don't say what. So you might just think, oh, there's just going to be some monster sound or something like that. But no, it's a very realistic crash sound.
They're going to be shaking foil to make rain sounds.
By the way, Left Right Game is a pretty interesting spooky horror podcast. And you should go listen to the first episode of it just for grins. It's the season, right? Go try it out.
It's the season. All right. Got a bunch of games this week.
Okay.
We got from Kickstarter. We got Return to Dark Tower, the big cooperative version of the classic Dark Tower game. I have played this. I think I've talked about it on the podcast. It is super cool. There are two left in the store. It comes with a big electronic Dark Tower that deposits skulls around the lands. It's got a ton of enemies, ton of characters. One of my favorite games to play. I think Matt Leacock was involved in redesigning it, so it's got one of the. It's got some co-op bona fides.
Yep. Somebody came through on Sunday, or
picked up everything.
And picked up like one of each of all the things.
So as a result, we have two of the main game, one of each expansion, and the expansions are one of them introduces four new characters, and one of them introduces new villains and stuff, and they introduce new skulls. So the skulls are like the cubes of Pandemic. They're like the things that come out. I know that one of them has Doom Skulls, which basically once they go out, they can't go back in.
Oh.
So it's like permanently adding board scars to the board. And I'm like, that's hard. But they're cool little metal.
I face enough Doom Skulls in life. I don't need it in my game as well.
You want the Doom Skulls. You don't want Doom, Leisure Doom Skulls. You want Life Doom Skulls.
No, that sounds very cool.
Yeah, it looks very cool.
I played the original Dark Tower back in the fabled years of the 1980s. I was there Gandalf 10,000 years ago.
You did play it, okay.
But I've never played the new one.
Okay.
So I would like to at some point do a compare contrast. Yep. It sounds like quite different, but meant to evoke the same feelings.
And then we got from Brotherwise Games another Kickstarter thing. We got it's called Empire's End. Brotherwise, you might recognize as the guys behind Boss Monster, Call to Adventure. I can't remember their other Overboss. These guys, pretty much every game they've done has been good.
Yeah.
And this new one is a. They call it a reverse bidding game. So you are ahead of a civilization, and disasters are threatening your empire, and you spend resources to avoid them. But if disaster strikes, you gain those resources and an innovation. So basically, there's a reason you might want to let some disasters actually strike your empire, because you might grow stronger afterwards.
Are these like ancient empires or like space empires?
These are ancient empires. So it's the disaster's like fire and
earthquake and Zeus thunderbolt.
Famine.
Okay.
Yeah. Volcano.
Volcano. Volcano is probably the last one.
Yeah.
It's ask the people of Pompeii how that went for them.
And Dante's Inferno.
But anyway, it looks super cool. And like I say, these guys have done pretty much nothing but good games. I see that it mentions a designer by name. Usually when there's a designer thing like high on it, I'm like, oh, this guy must be somebody. So now I'm just looking at Board Game Geek just to see. He is a designer from Los Angeles, California, if that helps.
Okay.
I see. He did Space Base, which was like the improvement on Machikoro, and this looks a little bit Space Base-y. He did Cubitos, which is kind of Mario Kart and Dice Game.
Yeah.
Mystic Veil, which I've heard good things of. So yeah.
He's not
no nobody.
He's a somebody.
Yep. And his picture on Board Game Geek, he looks like a cowboy.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear there's Zork Cowboy game designers out there. I wasn't sure if they were getting properly represented.
Yeah, they were their dying breed, the cowboy game designers. We got Vaesen Lost Mountain Saga. This is a new adventure for Vaesen, the sort of Germanic heavy metal RPG.
Yeah,
right?
But it's like supernatural mystery stuff, yeah. Right? Like, one thing I wasn't sure on those games is if they were quasi in the present, if they were in D&D fantasy times, or in some kind of Victorian-ish thing.
I believe they're in D&D fantasy times. I think you're like barbarians.
Okay.
I don't know.
I thought I saw some houses and things in there that looked a little bit more...
Barbarians had houses, Dave?
Like clay and like
they built clay houses
and dirt.
And it's not Germanic; it's Nordic.
It's Nordic, okay.
But I believe they have spread out to cover some, you know, other areas. Like there's some other games within it with different cultures and stuff.
Okay, all right. There's a game called Perspectives, which is a game. I think you're sort of cooperating, but each of you has a different viewpoint on the mystery. It's like a puzzle solving game.
Okay,
sounds fun. A game called That Sound Game, which looks like a party game. I didn't research too heavily on this one, but it looked looked interesting.
Okay.
We got Bargain Quest, the game of running a fantasy shop, has a new expansion, the first one in a while, called Brick and Mortar, which I'm sure just adds new adventurers, new stores, new goods, that kind of thing. We have a new edition of Hey, That's My Fish, nice. In which you are penguins trying to get fish.
Is that an all ages game?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I believe that's one that's always done quite well.
It's a much larger, like, deluxe edition.
Yeah, it's been out of print for a long time.
Unleash the Fish.
Starfinder Enhanced, which is the last first edition Starfinder thing. There's a lot of, like, they did something called Pathfinder Unchained a while back. This is kind of the other rules. It's like a different version of vehicle combat and some new tweaks to classes and that kind of stuff. Last little bit of first edition before they move into second edition Starfinder.
Okay.
A second edition of a game called Junk Orbit. The game's been out for a little while. A new game called Senjutsu Battle for Japan, which is you're doing like sword dueling fights.
Oh, okay.
It's supposed to be cool. A game called Tesseract, which is a dice-based co-op game that I've actually played, that you are trying to disarm a bomb by making patterns with different colored dice, and you have abilities that let you change dice colors or numbers. You can trade dice amongst each other.
Is there a timer?
There's not a specific timer, but there's a time built into the game.
Okay.
If you don't get rid of it before all the dice on the end go, the bomb goes off and you lose.
You die.
Yeah. Or so you die.
Is a timer.
Is it like one of those 80s games where the board goes pop and all the pieces fly up? And
no, thankfully
like,
it is not that. That is terrible. And who wants that?
I did see
small children.
A video the other day, a TikTok, if you will,
TikTok.
Of like a Gen Zer playing the game Operation, and was like, y'all did this for fun? So, what else we got?
Lunar Rush, which is a simultaneous play Euro-style board game, in which you are one of four major corporate conglomerates competing to mine the moon. For newly discovered wonder materials. This sounds very Terraforming Mars-ish.
Yeah.
Like, everybody upgrades at the same time. You put your workers down.
Oh,
seven
it's not,
turns.
Like, real-time, like...
No. It's just you're all moving...
Chaos.
You're all doing your stuff at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought that looked interesting. We got a whole bunch of Marvel Zombies expansions.
Mm-hmm.
There's the core X-Men game. You can get that and just play... That's a base game. And then there are expansions for the Fantastic Four... Guardians of the Galaxy, and Hydra, which I saw had She-Hulk and Ant-Man and a few others.
There's also a Spider-Man one, right?
No, Spider-Man was done before, I thought. Was Spider-Man new this time?
Yeah, this is like the Sinister Six one.
Oh,
the
Sinister Six, that's right. Yep, I saw that.
Yeah.
And we also have the Marvel Multiverse Dice. This is for the Multiverse role-playing game that they put out. It has a dice mechanic where, I think we've talked about this, that the middle die is the Marvel die, and if the Marvel comes up, you get a bonus.
Right.
And these are the dice that have the little Marvel dice. So... if you want to play the Marvel Multiverse games, they're pretty handy. We also got some D&D Plus charms. They're not blind. You can actually see what you're getting. You can buy a Modron.
Or an Owlbear.
An Owlbear.
Demogorgon or a... Boulet.
Don't you want a Boulet on your backpack?
Right.
You probably do.
Everybody wants a Modron.
Well...
And... I don't know if we talked about this last week, but we did get a restock on Acerax. We learned it's not Acerax.
The mystery bags of D&D dice a dice bag
and a metal coin.
And a metal coin that's like
Bardic Inspiration, or,
right? They're like
or rage or something like that.
Yeah, they look cool. When you come in and you're considering it, look at the pictures on the side. The dice are very cool looking.
Yeah.
But my favorite is the coins, which look like, you know, if you ever see like Roman coins and stuff like that, where they're a little more rough hewn. And they look very cool, all the different ones.
For sure.
We also got an order of the plush tote bags.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That are sort of, they've got like dragons and foxes, and they're just kind of a fun little idea.
Yeah. It's a Christmas time is coming. Figure we need more plushes.
Sure. Yep.
And in general, some fun little stocking stuffer type things.
Yep. All right. Let's talk about the last week of comics for the. Nope. I lied. That'll be next week.
Yep.
I mean, sort of, because it'll be November 1st.
Slow down, but... Randy. I know you're trying to get past Halloween because it's so scary.
Yeah, I'm spooked. I'm scared. this is, we've got Alan Scott Green Lantern, which is the third of, I think, three miniseries.
That are JSA?
That are JSA focused.
So which ones have we seen so far? We saw the Sandman one.
And Flash.
A.K.A. Wesley Dodds Sandman.
And Jay Garrick.
And yeah, so Alan Scott Green Lantern is a story of him in the 1930s, I believe, the build up to World War II.
Correct.
You know, he was like one of the first superheroes ever. I guess he didn't predate Superman, but he was pretty close to him.
And he is sort of the heavy hitter of the JSA. Although when you got the Spectre, the literal wrath of God.
But he didn't used to be that powerful. I think he just did little spells and ditties.
Okay, so...
I am, and I would be shocked if they mentioned the word God in those early
ones.
You're
saying Green Lantern's more powerful than God.
Yes, I'm saying that. Just like when the Beatles were more popular than God.
Yes.
So too Green Lantern.
Yes.
And this sort of tells a tale of back when Alan Scott was... Is he a Navy guy in this, or is he...
He's working for the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay, Army Corps of Engineers, yes.
And it's interesting because... They are retconning in something pretty important in that Alan Scott is now canonically gay.
Right. The way this kind of started to happen was that there was an Earth 2 version. Yeah, that's true. They could play it as bi.
Well, he did have kids.
Is that still in there?
We don't know.
I mean, I know Jade's still around, so...
Yeah, I just never know. Jeff Johns is always tinkering with the timeline. I never know
that's true.
A character might have disappeared without me knowing it.
That's true.
But yes, some years ago they did their Earth 2 series that was really pretty successful. It was like circa, New 52 or one of those relaunches.
Tom Taylor.
Tom Taylor and James Robinson both had very notable runs on that. James Robinson launched it. And it had, the JSA were a contemporary team, and they were modern, I mean, complete rethinks of like them just based with using the names and the character identity names. But yes, that version of Alan Scott was gay. And frequently confused in news media because people were like, oh, they thought it was the mainline DC Prime universe, whatever it is, and everybody freaked out. But that is the case now.
Yep,
they are sort of merging versions, I guess. And I think we all liked it.
I think it's actually exploring it here is interesting because in the 1930s, being a gay man was very, very different. This opens with FBI Director Herbert or Hoover.
Yes.
Not Herbert Hoover, but...
J. Edgar Hoover. Yes.
Who was, I believe, the rumor was he was gay and closeted himself.
Right. I believe he was... Wasn't he the one who was supposedly dressed in the ladies' clothes and stuff like that? And...
Or maybe he was straight, just a cross-dresser. I don't know.
Right.
At any rate, he is basically blackmailing Alan Scott with photos of him and another guy.
Yeah, he's like, we have better... Like, well, first of all... Alan Scott does not have a public identity.
Right.
He goes in to see him, and he's like, hey, Alan, or whatever, and he's like, what? And he's like, don't try and play coy with me. He's definitely strong-arming him and not being cool about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm really hoping that at the end of this, or sometime soon, that Alan Scott serves him up.
I feel like it's an accurate representation of who J. Edgar Hoover was.
I think it is. I think it is. This was at a time when, like, the FBI was, like, really consolidating power.
Yep.
One of the things I really liked in this was Doyby Dickles, his weird...
Yeah,
his
I loved
pick.
It. Yeah.
He's all like, hey, man, you know, you could be... Again, in the time of the 30s, he's like, you know what? There's nothing wrong with what you're doing. You're not a delinquent. And he's like, but I don't need the details on what you do.
Yeah. I actually appreciated that, like, that they didn't make him, like, so progressive that... Yep. That it just felt completely wrong for the era.
The line is, on account of who you fool around with ain't no none of their business. You're a hero. And then he's like, Derby, I knowingly and repeatedly commit felonious acts with other men. He's like, whoa, I don't judge yous, but I don't need no details on what yous all do with the felonies. That's pretty good.
Doiby Dickles is like, as a concept, as a name,
yep.
I am aware of, but it's like the doofiest sounding sidekick name, and yet I liked his character.
He's his driver, right? Isn't he his driver, basically?
Is that what it is?
I think he was a cabbie who became his private
it's
driver.
It's very kind of Shadow-esque.
I was like, how wealthy is this guy?
Yeah. He's wealthy.
He's one of them wealthy heroes.
He's one of the 1%.
He's got to get wrecked.
But anyway,
I hope Hoover destroys him.
But yeah, it's a good first issue. And like, as with all the these so far, they've done a pretty good job of like taking what's interesting about the JSA and doing a good period piece thing with them.
Now, which is weirder, is it Doiby Dickles or Woozy Winks? Because that was Plastic Man.
Here's the thing. Woozy Wings, like, Plastic Man, as it was written in those early days, was like half a humor comic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, a wacky character fit in that. Doiby Dickles was in ostensibly one of the early big superhero comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and I'm like, that is ridiculous.
What's
that
weirder, Doiby Dickles or Space Cappy?
I'm not sure if you realize or anything. His name is Doiby Dickles. I don't know how many times we have to say it.
What's weirder, Space Cabby or Ultra the Multi?
Come to the conclusion that Doiby is the weirdest of them all.
US One.
You're right. US One. Where's US One fun in all of this? That, for folks who don't know, is Marvel's Super Trucker.
Yes.
All right.
In case you missed the 80s.
We got a one-shot for Hallows Eve by Erica Schultz, who's been doing most of the writing of this character. Hallows Eve is Chasm, a.k.a. Ben Reilly's girlfriend, who has masks that give her superpowers. And in this one, she runs afoul of some zombies.
Okay.
There is a new Captain Marvel number one. I think the most notable thing, of course, is probably that this is they slightly tweaked her costume, which I think is a little weird, given that she's... Like, the costume is a big part of Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
But they gave her sort of a cool... jacket look.
Yep, I thought it looked a little matador-ish.
Yeah, it's not bad.
And I believe Jen Bartel did the design, perhaps?
I think that's right.
And that's she knows how to draw.
Yep.
But more than that, she knows how to... She has a good sense of design.
Yes.
Introduced a new villain, and is bringing in another Captain Marvel character.
There's an unusual sort of ally-frenemy kind of situation that's going on that I think is kind of... I think that's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I thought it was a good setup.
Yeah. We have a new Black, White, and Red series that is Marvel Zombies, which has three... It's the anthology format, so it's three stories, one of which is by Garth Ennis. Garth Ennis' Daredevil story, which was interesting.
Yep.
And then there's a Spider-Man story and a Moon Knight story.
The Moon Knight was weird.
Has Garth Ennis done anything for Marvel for a while, by the way?
Not for a little while.
I feel like it's been years and years and years and years and years.
But anyway, this is, you know, you either know or you know you, if you're into this or not, but the Black, White, and Red, if you like it, this was a pretty cool, like, three little vignettes of the Marvel Zombies. There's going to be more of them. This is a mini-series.
Yep. This is a six-issue mini, I think.
Moving on to Image, we've got Universal Monsters Dracula, issue one, from the Department of Truth team of James Tinian and Martin Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like this. This is the Universal Monsters version of Dracula.
But there's tweaked within that. Still, like, Tinian gets to do his makeover.
For sure. Well, I thought it was interesting. He talked about it in his little afterword, which I don't know if you read.
Yeah, I did.
He's like, I thought I was done with other people's characters, but then we finished Department of Truth, and they sort of pitched us Universal Monsters, and we sort of decided to do this Dracula thing. So, the Universal Monsters Dracula starts in London. Or at least this version of it. It's all the London stuff. There's none of the Transylvania stuff. But it is all... Renfield and Lucy and Mina and Harker.
I believe there's like maybe Dr. Seward might be in there.
Yep, Dr. Seward's in there.
They mentioned Quincy, the like pal of Jonathan Harker,
I think. Is that Quincy, he's not Van Helsing?
There's a cowboy dude. There's a Texan dude.
Oh, Quincy,
dude,
that's
traditionally,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I forget his full name, but...
The Simmons art is spectacular. I forget how good this guy is.
It's that fully painted look, and it reminds me of artists like, like Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah.
But also, I'm thinking of 80s artists like John J. Muth and the dude who did
Ben
Wolverine
Temple Smith is the most recent.
Yeah, Ben Temple Smith.
There's a few pages towards the end where it's kind of wordless and kind of this etherealness to it that really kind of sell it for me.
If you like Dracula vampire imagery and stuff that kind of stuff, definitely flip through this. Check out how amazing the art looks, or look some up online. Just
I just want to point out, though, in his back up, he does say that his first Dracula movie was the Mel Brooks Dracula Dead and Loving It.
He's like, that was the first one I saw, and he's like, but somehow I knew what Transylvania was, I knew what vampires were, and I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, his notion is that he already, as a kid, even, like, had a fully formed idea of who Dracula was, even before he saw the parody, somehow.
I mean, that makes sense. It's all infused throughout pop culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Tony Daniel, the artist and co-writer of
Noctera,
has his own new book called Edenwood, which is a post-apocalyptic fantasy.
Yep.
So if you've been liking Noctera, you might want to check this out. Jerry Duggan has a... if you know Jerry Duggan, you know him from X-Men and maybe Iron Man. But you also know he's got this weird, like, other side to him. Which is a side that smokes a lot of pot.
His underground stoner side.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's the one that's being represented here. is a Halloween one-shot about a guitarist who gets dragged into a fantasy realm, and there's some horror stuff. It's weird, man. It's weird.
Yeah, that is a good summation. Very weird.
But if you're looking for a weird pot-infused horror one-shot, we got you covered. Boom is a book called Slow Burn, which is a sort of a trippy crime book.
Oh, I meant to read that one.
It's I forget who this artist is. Pierluigi Minotti, which I don't know, but really pretty art that reminds me of sort of I want to say, I don't remember who it is now, but it's a good look, and it is a something happens, like it was like a crime or a robbery gone wrong, and they wind up hanging out hiding out in some farmhouse. And there's some weird trippy stuff going on.
We've all been there.
And then we got Giant Robot Hellboy, in which Hellboy becomes a giant robot.
Is that in fact what happens?
That's in fact what happens.
All right. He becomes a giant robot?
Well, they put him into some machine. It's like he controls a kaiju-sized
Hellboy makes more sense.
Robot that they built to distract a monster while their actual operative tries to steal something off Monster Island. So, yeah. Notable second issue this week, we got Captain America number 2 from JMS. And Jesus Sayas, nice art. He's telling an interesting story about young Steve Rogers running in with the Bund, the fascists of the that were trying to bring Nazism to America during the lead up to World War II.
Yep. No idea why this would have any relevance now, but just something you might just to think about.
Immortal Thor number 3, which has Thor being sort of outwitted by Loki in a sort of a running puzzle thing.
I thought that was
like a meeting of minds.
It's a cool setup, though. Yeah. So I'm going to quick just say, in the last issue, he had to use the Odin Sight or whatever,
right?
And now he, you know, because he has taken on that role, so it's like the Thor Sight. And then normally Odin would have to do the Odin Sleep afterwards, and now he has to do the Thor Sleep, and he's going to be like out of it for a while. And this is something interesting. I don't know if they specified this in previous iterations, but he's, like, vulnerable.
Yes.
That's the one time people can, like, one-shot kill
him. He said that, like, a mortal could, like, kill him while he's in this state. And essentially he wakes up in a strange and alien environment. He realized that Loki has in some way placed him here, and he's trapped there. And like y'all said, it's a sort of a skirmish of wits. Loki seems to be... have trapped him there, but he seems to want to get something out of Thor, puzzling his way out. And it's an interesting stuff. Al Ewing is continuing to do a good job on Immortal Thor.
They refer to it as the All Sleep. Now.
The All Sleep. There we
also,
go. That's what I'm going to try and on like Saturday or Sunday this weekend. I'm going to try and get the All Sleep in.
I will also say this artist's rendition of Thor with beard is very good.
It looks good.
I really am enjoying Martin Kukola's artwork in this book. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really like what the two of them, Ewing and Kukola, are doing with Loki.
Yeah.
Where every time Loki shows up, I noted that Thor's using they-them pronouns for Loki.
Yep, yeah.
It's a change. And that every time Loki shows up, it's a different aspect.
Yep.
Like, there's like the femme Loki that shows up, and then there's like the president Loki that shows up. And
is there like a distinct, I think like at least one that's kind of fairly decidedly non-binary?
Yeah.
That we've seen before, and you know, I kind of appreciate that Thor takes it in stride. He's used to Loki being this mercurial being.
My favorite moment in this issue, though, is when Thor gets annoyed. Loki shows back up, and Thor throws the hammer at his head.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's like, Thor's like,
just stand
there a minute. And Loki just transforms into, like, green butterflies and transforms back, which is a really cool little moment.
Yeah.
Also, I thought the stinger was really good.
The stinger's great. I'm super excited for the next issue.
Yeah.
And then we got Void Rivals number 5, which continues the development of the sort of sci-fi universe that Kirkman's building. I gotta say, I'm a little weirded out by the Transformers content at this point. It almost feels like it shouldn't be there.
I think they're slowly building it into something. Because what they deal with in this one...
I think we can just say, because it's been several issues of mentioning these characters, the Quintessons, who, you know, if you watch any Transformers after the Transformers
Judge,
movie...
Jury, Executioner, Robots.
Yeah, they have a role to play in this, but it is right now relegated to a subplot.
Yeah.
But it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
They do seem to have heard of the Void Rivals...
They're actually very interested in...
We'll see where that goes.
How they connect up, yeah.
But I'm actually liking all the kind of political intrigue, freedom fighterness of the of the main story, too. I like these characters. I like his handbot. Mm-hmm. Feels very much a reminiscent of the Richard Rider World Mind.
It's a sci-fi thing, but it's that kind of like slightly pulp sci-fi, so that it's kind of fun, too. You know what's interesting? It is interesting to think that, like, you know, at some point, the Daniel Warren Johnson's core Transformers book, which, by the way, is, like, we have sold a ton of, like, ridiculous numbers. And here's the thing. We're not just trying to move them. We put a management guarantee on it. People are really liking it.
Yeah.
And no one's brought it back.
No one's brought it back. I've only heard people report back with good stuff.
Yep.
But, like, they could run into at this point, like, you know, they're clearly setting, you know, reestablishing the early classic early Transformers stuff in a new way. But... they could run into the Quintessons at this point. They could come run into the Void Rivals, and it would be kind of a neat shared universe thing. I think when that happens, it's going to feel kind of neat.
I agree. There's also a cool backup in most of these things that feature the first four pages of Duke. The
first four pages of Duke, which are really good.
The artwork is fantastic.
Yeah.
So the upcoming comics, there's going to be Duke, and there's a Cobra Commander one, and is that it right now?
Yes.
And we know that both of them involve sort of small teams.
There's some changes in the teams, too.
We know that there's going to be some betrayal.
I think we can say...
Yeah, that we've seen who the lineup is.
So Joe is Duke, Hawk, Stalker, and Baroness.
Yes, Baroness is going to somehow be a member of the Joe's team when it starts. This is clearly one of the big things that will set this apart from previous iterations.
I think it's a cool idea. I think you could mine some really interesting stories by having Baroness... affiliated with U.S. military.
I imagine she is going to be a super great agent of theirs, and when she inevitably turns, it's going to be a hard hit to them, and that will make her that much bigger a villain. I think that's a neat idea.
And then Cobra Commander, Destro, Zarana.
Yeah, which is
instead
kind
of Zartan,
unusual.
Which I think is cool. Right. Their
oddball
is Mercer.
Right, which is a character best known from the G.I. Joe movie.
Yep.
He was at the time working for Sergeant Slaughter's like special ops team and was an ex-Cobra. So
Slaughter's Marauders.
Is fairly... We can probably pretty easily presume he will, in fact, defect from Cobra at some point. But whether that'll happen or how long it'll take, who knows?
But originally he's like a... I think he's like a drill sergeant of the Vipers, if I'm not mistaken, or...
Maybe. I didn't know if he was that or an officer or what.
Or maybe he's an officer in the Vipers.
Yeah, interesting.
But yeah, they've got some cool stuff in place, and it bodes well that the preview pages of Duke were both well-drawn, I thought, and some good story stuff.
So. Yep.
Also worth mentioning, Predator vs. Wolverine number 2 came out this week. That's been running a little late.
So, and then this one is dealing with, what were they called?
Team X? Something like that?
It's not Task Force X.
I thought they were called Team X.
It's that what Nick is talking about.
It's like
that
the Canadian Special Forces group.
Right. It had Wolverine, Maverick,
Sabretooth,
Omega Red.
No, that was like the villain that they
were going in after.
But it was all those special ops dudes.
But if you were wondering where they were going to do kind of like a Predator riff. The second issue is very kind of Predator. Them
specifically
in the jungle.
You're talking about the Predator movie, the original movie.
Yeah, but it's a cool setup where Wolverine and his team are going up against a team of Predators. And I thought that was a really cool idea.
And then we've got Gone number 1, the new book written and drawn by Jock.
Yep.
From Distillery, the guys who are the new publisher. Everything they do is in this sort of oversized format. It's really pretty. It's sort of a sci-fi...
Their lineup of creators is pretty intense.
Yeah.
It looks like the DC Black Label format, yeah. You know, that oversized but with a spine on it. But
yeah, this is like a sort of a sci-fi introductory, a world where the rich own everything, and this is about the sort of the poor people trying to run some kind of military operation to... It's very much in Jock's wheelhouse.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, what is Jock for the average person most famous for? There's probably Green Arrow Year One.
Maybe.
I don't know. He also did that Vertigo project that got made into a movie that kind of
bombed.
The Losers.
Nobody even knows about that anymore. Yeah. It's out of print.
But it had some amazing art in it.
Yeah.
He might be best known for that Batman cover where all the bats make up the Joker face or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's what he's known for, Batman.
He's done a lot of great covers. Did he also do some work when Scott Snyder was doing backups and Jason...
Batman the Black Mirror stuff.
So that might have been the most recent project people saw him on, but he's a good artist.
So then we've got this. I'm very excited about this. Dungeons & Dragons Knights of Endless Adventure trade. This is the second one. The previous was Days of Endless Adventure. This is three story arcs from Jim Zub's D&D stuff, which all ties into whatever books they were putting out or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So this has Evil at Baldur's Gate, Infernal Tides, and Mindbreaker, all of which tie into Baldur's Gate 3. So if you've been playing Baldur's Gate 3 and you wanted some more stories of, like, Mind Flayers and Avernus and I'm sure stuff that shows up in Act 3 of Baldur's Gate that I haven't gotten to yet, it is all in here along with Minsk and
Boo. Why haven't you gotten to Act 3? Is there possibly another game that
came
out?
There's another game, but that's not why. I've just been busy. It's spooky season, Nick. I don't have time for video games.
There's a couple of other single issues to mention, too. The second issue of Rare Flavors, the Anthony Bourdain...
Right.
About a Rakshasa wanting to do a weird film about food.
Right.
But also eat people.
Yep.
The third issue of Marvel Unleashed, the Animal Avengers book. Which is by Kyle Starks and is a delight every single time it comes out.
Yep.
Third issue of Uncanny Avengers, which was pretty solid. And I didn't get a chance to read it, but if you Amazon's Attack, which is the new DC Amazon's book.
Right.
And also, we may not like Tom King, but we should mention his Wonder Woman number 2.
Yeah, and the Amazon's Attack is definitely kind of filling in some gaps there.
And the second printing of Wonder Woman number 1 also came out. But yes, also worth mentioning, Flash number 2 came out this
week. Yeah, I was out of town when this hit, and I'm going to try and sit down with it and check it out. I know you've liked it all right, Nick. This is the sort of supernatural horror-tinged Flash. There's something weird with the Speed Force.
I will say I liked it more than All Right. I think it is... because I am not a big Cy Spurrier fan, and I actually actively poo-pooed it when I heard that it was going to be sort of a cosmic horror Flash, and I was like, that sounds dumb.
Right. I don't think any of us would think, like, you know what Flash needs? Darkness.
Well, no, but it's like the interesting...
But this is not super grim dark.
No, it's not super grim dark, and it's introducing some interesting stuff along the same lanes of like what they've done with the current John Stewart book, where they're introducing a new threat. This is a new threat for Flash that is utilizing a couple of like his classic rogues gallery. But dealing with kind of a Speed Force being kind of actively not working completely for him, which I thought was a neat idea.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty cool.
If Tinian wrote it, it'd be called Something Is Wrong With The Speed Force.
It's true.
We've got, speaking of Tinian, Nice House in the Lake, his horror book that was 2 volumes trades, has a one nice hardcover that has the whole thing in one story.
Yep. So if you're a fancy man.
The Astro City Metro Book series, I believe, concludes with Volume 4.
It looked like it.
I think this catches us up to everything that's been published so far.
We've sung the virtues of Astro City many a time.
Yep.
So you should, if you haven't read this, start with Volume 1. But good to see that they had a clear vision on this project, and it wasn't like some of those other... Every once in a while, Astro City's been reprinted a little haphazardly. And this is a very nice iteration of it. This seems like the definitive one.
Maybe now they can get to some new material, which
They were talking about doing original graphic novels. If they don't, if they never get around anymore, it's somewhat appropriate. The final story of Astro City will have been Ape Man Blues about a talking ape who becomes a drummer.
That's
a superpower group.
I remember that was good.
That's the last page of Astro City. That's not so bad.
No,
if it goes out on that. That feels fitting.
Also, by the way, you know, I know that some of that was just literally Busiek's health issues over the decades.
Yeah.
He literally, he requires, like, the his clearest thought when he's writing that, because he's there's a lot of stuff he's juggling in it thematically.
Yep.
And he has some stuff that caused a little bit of the old, like, brain fog type stuff. So.
Did Brent Harrison do all of the artwork?
No, they did bring some artists in.
Much of it. The vast majority of it.
But yeah, the majority of it is Brent Harrison. Parker Girls Omnibus is out this week. If you are a Terry Moore fan, that I really like this. It's a return to the sort of...
The girl gang.
Hooker espionage is what I would call it.
All right, you can call it that.
Because that's what they are. They're hookers and spies, but they're spies for good. Or something. I don't know. I really enjoyed this.
I feel like sex workers is where we want to call them now, right?
No, these are definitely hookers.
Terry Moore, sex worker, spies.
Yes. Terry Moore's a good guy, good girl artist type.
He's also a horn dog?
He's also a bit of a horn dog. Sure. So yeah, this is probably a little problematic in some ways what he's doing, but it's fun. And it's hard is in the right place. So I enjoyed that, and I definitely looking forward to reading all of it. And then also one of these big giant hardcovers from DK Books, the Marvel Cinematic Universe timeline, that basically plots all the movies onto a timeline of when they happen. All the events of the MCU.
That's interesting.
Full of different, you know, art and well done.
Right, it's the DK Books guys, so they always come through on that stuff.
Yeah, it was good. All right, we're gonna take a break, and then we're gonna come back and talk about spooky season movie and TV, and probably a video game and some board games. All right, so we talked last week about Fall of the House of Usher.
Yep.
We have now all finished it.
Yes.
And so we're going to talk about the second half, because we talked about episodes 1 through 4. Now we're going to talk about what's in episodes 4 through 8, and I want to real quick pull up what's in episodes 4 through 8.
So right, I just want the fourth episode I know ended with the Black Cat episode.
Right.
That was the finale.
So have you seen the article running around that Flanagan kind of did a thing about that episode, that the cat never died?
Oh.
That was all in his head, because the very end, the cat had the Gucci collar on its neck.
I did not catch that.
I don't think I particularly caught that. What was the deal with the Gucci collar?
That was, like, because that was his big thing. It was like, it costs so much.
Right.
And he's like,
So basically, so it was all, so Carlo Gugino's character will murder children, but will not kill a cat.
Won't kill animals.
All right, good to know.
I mean, I think I knew that because the way they edited it, when that guy takes a tumble off the balcony, we see for a minute that he's lunging for the cat, but then we see the point of view of the other person in the house.
Yeah,
you don't see the cat.
And the cat's not there. Like, as if it wasn't.
Yeah. I'm just saying, then they show the cat with the Gucci collar so that the cat was never killed.
I'm just glad the cat was never killed. That was a very harsh little scene.
No, I've had several friends who are talking about it, and they're like, be warned, there's some real cat violence. And I'm like, there's some real, I mean, everybody gets doused with acid in episode 2. The cat violence is the problem?
Actually, this is kind of a thing.
There is something different with animals, and I think it's because, part of it is because there is, like, not a lot of actual poor acid on people violence in the world, but there are people who kill animals.
Okay. Yes.
And the one time you did see it, it looked like it had just been, stabbed?
Yep.
He, like, grabs its eye, puts his thumbs into its eyes.
Right, but that was, like, in Dream Sequence Land whatever, yeah.
There's animal violence, and then there's kind of Sam Raimi animal violence.
Right. But anyways, that is a weird fixation for this story to go on, because that's overall a pretty small part of this show.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, I didn't realize it.
You're happy the cat made it.
I just found it interesting that
probably like, it's like some kind of demon cat or something like that, or an agent of whatever Verna is.
I believe it was actually Carla Gugino. I believe she was meant to embody the cat.
That would make sense.
So the remaining episodes, look at the titles, The Telltale Heart, Goldbug, Pit and the Pendulum, and The Raven, which I believe will remind you guys all, and anyone who's seen it, what the four episodes are we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Telltale Heart was maybe one of the most grisly things outside of the acid bath.
Yeah, it's...
It's a pretty grisly thing.
The Telltale Heart has to do with the
Victorine,
wife...
Victorine and her surgeon wife.
Girlfriend.
Girlfriend?
Uh-huh.
Girlfriend.
I think girlfriend.
Yeah. And
they're kind of... medical equipment about the kind of graft onto your heart.
Yeah. Right. Oh, interestingly, I thought you were talking for a minute about... I actually could not remember quite what that episode was for a second, and I was thinking of the later episode where we see the wife in the full body cast thing of...
Oh, right.
What's his name? And I was like, that was actually the sort of most excruciating thing for me. What's interesting is, you know, there's...
That's pretty brutal, too.
We've talked about the... I've seen and debated on the internet world whether how horror this show this is because it's not like real scary, but it is definitely a macabre story. And like it's not like all of Poe's stories were like you read Mask of the Red Death and you're like, oh, I'm so scared, it made me jump so many times. No. That's not what he does, but he does do. He can be macabre and grisly himself, and this accurately reflects.
Yeah, this is like a pure reflection of Edgar Allan Poe stuff.
but it's also got that stuff that is very uniquely, of course, Mike Flanagan, the writer director, which is all the character sort of drama and stuff. And but yeah, so in the one we're talking about, God, what did happen in that? You had so,
The heart isn't working. They're trying to fix the heart thing for her dad.
Right, it's like an artificial heart that could help him with essentially the dementia that he's got going on because it controls like blood
Victorine's
vessels.
Victorine's girlfriend finds out that Victorine forged some papers, like her signature on
and
stuff.
And she's out, and there's a pretty horrific thing that happens as a result of that. I don't want to spoil that too much.
Right.
But then Victorine starts hearing something.
Right.
Hearing kind of this weird chirping sound.
Yep. And this will not come as a shock for people who have been watching it. Like, probably one of the first things I realized when I was, like, early episodes was, oh, they're creating an artificial heart. This is in some way going to be the telltale
heart. Right, sure. Yeah.
In the story, I forget why. It's a guy who's, like, working for, I think, some old man and essentially just kills the old man.
He kills him, yeah.
Yeah.
Then he buries him under the floorboards. Yep. He keeps hearing the heart. Yeah.
I like to quote the line in that where he talks about how he's talking to, like, the reader, and he's like, I spent a whole hour just opening, like, his door 1 inch just to, like, peer into his room while he slept or whatever. And he's like, would a madman be that careful? And I'm like, that's some beautiful writing there.
Goldbug is a very obscure Poe story. It's more of his, like, detective fiction. I didn't know this one.
Yep, it's not
apparently,
one I know.
Apparently it's a guy who becomes fixated on a gold-colored bug. And they go, he ropes people into an adventure after suffering a secret message that will lead to a buried treasure.
In this case, it's this was referring to like a scarab, sort of like an Egyptian symbol, right?
Yes. Well, no, this is a... Goldbug is the name of her wellness brand.
It's very goop. Yeah.
There is a scarab thing that turns up, but is that a separate story?
Well, no, the scarab is the logo.
The logo, that's right.
That's on the box.
Yeah.
This is about...
Sort of a eternal life Egypt kind of, ancient Egypt sort
but
of
But this
deal.
Is, I forget her name.
Tamerlane,
who, she's the actress that played the, evil nun in, The Last Flanagan, the Midnight Mass.
Midnight Mass, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's she was pure evil.
She's been all of these. She was one of the sisters in the original, right?
I believe so.
You know, all the characters in this we've probably said before are kind of bad people.
Yes.
Not completely without exception, but the vast majority of the characters are pretty bad. Many of them somewhat unrepentantly so.
Weirdly, I feel bad for Tamerlane.
She was arrogant and self-destructive,
I didn't feel like she was outright evil. She was, like, super narcissistic and kind of, like... all about the company, but...
No, she had it coming.
Doesn't she...
She's horrible to her husband.
Her husband at one point.
Says you're easily replaceable.
And she goes into full terrible mode.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the things all kind of come to a head for her when she has to make the big presentation on their new product. And this is, like, in front of a live audience. This is one of those, hey, take the thing out from under your seat. Try a sample. This is our vision for the 21st century. All of that kind of, like, PR stuff. And she's clearly somebody who's usually very good at this.
And she
is suffering weird visions while it happens.
her visions are making her crazy and saying weird shit.
It did crack me up. Like, this is fascinating and painful to watch.
Yeah.
When it starts, when they're about to call her out, like, somebody's about to introduce her, she comes out and she says, she's like, what the fuck are you doing?
doing here? And then she has to cover it.
Yeah, and she actually, it looks like she's going to for a minute. But she's like,
what the fuck are we all doing
she's
here?
What are we all doing here? It's like, that's what we came here to talk about.
Yeah.
And she kind of recovers it and gets it on the pack. And they think, I think the audience is like, oh, that was just a jarring get it going kind
of
deal.
This destruction was seeded earlier in one of the other episodes.
Yeah.
Because Verna shows up as sort of the prostitute that kind of deals with her husband.
Right, right. She has a weird, she has a weird kinky thing goes on where she watches a prostitute sort of playing her role, like at the dinner table and other stuff.
Yeah.
And having sex with her husband and strange stuff. This is by the way, an R-rated series if we haven't mentioned it.
But I also say
yes, that was seated, and if we didn't say, you know, just as a reminder, Verna is the recurring character who seems to be dishing out brutal justice on these characters.
Which last night you kind of dropped a bomb on me, saying that Verna is an anagram for the Raven.
Yep, Raven.
I didn't get it.
I didn't get the anagram, but she is the Raven.
I get that. Yeah.
We knew that, and yet I had never just made the word association.
I had not made that word association. That's pretty cool. This has two of my favorite, like, brutal physical moments in here. One is when she, Tamerlane is freaking out, and she throws the chair, or whatever.
There's a microphone.
There's a microphone.
Yeah.
And just nails her stepmother, the poor, like, 20-year-old junkie
who she hates in the face.
Yeah. Like, I was like, oh, poor Juno just really gets abused throughout this. Although she gets one of the happier endings.
She does.
Right. Juno, and Juno gets some more time as this one goes along. Yeah. She has a... And they, who's she talking to? It's his sister, isn't it? Madeline? They have a somewhat extended conversation, and
because she's like, you're the one good spot. You could bring the people back to us because of the goodwill that your boxes will.
The way that Juno is treated in this has been so awful throughout the whole thing. She is the young recovering addict who lost a leg in an accident, and then, like, the whole heart of this thing, which has been the pharmaceutical empire of the Usher family, with its opioid painkillers that, on the surface, seem safe, but apparently, you know, actually do over prolonged periods.
Well, they're not habit-forming.
But over prolonged periods, we know that there's, like, intense addiction.
Well, and she's, like, taking, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of, like, 72 pills a day.
She's at a higher dosage because her addiction to heroin, somehow, some weird chemistry thing that she can handle more of this drug than anybody else. And so Roderick is using her as like the
guinea pig.
He said, look, my wife takes it all the time. She's fine.
And she actually wants to get off of it. Yeah. And he's like, oh, how would that look for the company if, you know, like its most famous, you know, patient drops it? And he's like, well, she's clearly like, just a useful tool for the company.
But then he's all like, yeah, but you don't want to do that.
Well, no, the doctor tells her all the deal of what's going to happen, right? Or is it him?
I thought it was him. I thought it was
3 years of suffering to potentially kick it.
Was it him? I thought the doctor told her all that.
I forget.
I thought it was Roderick.
I thought the doctor told her all that, and Roderick just basically reinforced it. But anyway, the last conversation for the two of them is pretty brutal.
Yep.
When she basically reveals, she calls him a monster, and he's like, no, you're the monster, and I'm Victor Frankenstein. And that was ruthless. I was like, damn.
He also, there was a point in one of the earliest scenes with her at the family meeting where she starts to say something, and somebody says something like, why is it talking, talking, and they call her it.
That's the sibling that's based off of the Incredibles character.
The PR sibling.
Right. Who visually, at least, was based off Mirage from the Incredibles.
The penultimate episode is called Pit in the Pendulum. It deals with Freddy, who is the oldest of the siblings.
And the worst.
And the worst.
Frederick, a.k.a. Froderick.
He wasn't the worst. The worst was definitely Perry, until Perry...
Was Perry the worst?
Perry's pretty bad.
Perry was all about, like, blackmailing the uber rich.
He wanted sleazy fame. I have to say, I think that Freddy's, like, essentially tormenting his wife.
No. I'm saying, before we get to that, saying is, before they all started going crazy, Freddy wasn't the worst. He was the one who was basically the heir apparent. He was a useless,
parasite.
Blue blood, but he was not a bad guy.
I told Nick,
he was building ships and bottle with his kid.
Early on, my sister and I were talking about, like, these are pretty bad, or at the very least extremely narcissistic and very ambitious people, and like the in a very bad sense, not good ambition, but bad ambition. Very self-interested. And I was like, you know, Freddy seems okay when his wife went to the hospital because of the acid thing.
Yeah.
It's like, everybody else was talking about how does this look for the company.
Yep.
And he at least was like, is she okay and stuff? And I thought...
This is what I'm saying. I just finished episode 2 rewatching with a friend.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, Freddy seems okay. I mean, he's a doof. He's a useful doof.
You want to believe in him a little bit, by the way, because he's played by grown-up Elliot from E.T.
Right.
Yes. He's also obsessed with bowling.
But yeah, the place where he goes in this episode,
yeah,
because he's been driven to madness by his wife's situation, and the is Verna the one who gave him the phone? Somebody gave him the phone. It's like driving him to this.
Well, this is the one I think sibling that Verna actively goes out of her way to murder.
Well, because of what he's done.
Yes.
But yeah, the stuff he does is awful, and the sort of the tension between like. What is the daughter going to figure out? What's going to happen to the mom and all that kind of stuff?
And this is where they started to give more agency and screen time to Lenore, his daughter, and maybe the best person of the show. I guess not maybe. Maybe she is.
Yes, she is.
Juno doesn't have any great sins, but she, you know, other than having been manipulated.
Yeah.
Like, that's really... And that's, like, in the situation she was in, it's fairly understandable... But Lenore is a little bit of the shining light.
Yep.
But yes, that is a disturbing episode.
In this episode, do we also get the conversation between Verna and Mark Hamill?
No. That's the final episode.
But by the way, before we leave this episode, I will say Freddy's end, and we know that these characters all meet their end. Man, that was intense.
And super clever, by the way, to be able to work the pendulum in that way.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering how they would, and I thought, oh, it's just going to be the wrecking ball.
Yeah.
It's going to have to act in for that, and I'm like, that'll work. And I think, essentially, it was a bit of a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a very satisfying sequence.
Yeah, it was. The final episode is a great episode, because it has... Yes, we finally get the answer of what exactly the ushers did on that night in 1979.
Yep. Somewhere in there we get the Cask of Amontillado story worked
in. I'm so disappointed in myself for not seeing that coming. I should have seen that coming from minute one when we've got the jester costume. It's called Fortunato, Kevin. Yep. Like, I should have seen that coming. That's one of the post stories I really like.
Yeah.
And they managed to distract me long enough that I did not pick up on what was going on until that dude was in the wall.
Yeah.
Oh, you really? I was waiting for it the whole time, and I was like, oh, whenever Roderick was staring at the wall, I'm like, it's clearly something that's going to link to that. But there are actually several stories about people getting untimely burials and Poe, and I was like, well, it could link to one of those, too. And there's no episode titled The Cask of Amontillado.
Right.
But by the way...
Hit the highlight.
There's all these gory ends, but somewhat like Poe himself, and like we're going to talk about this later, the Corman adaptation that you watch, Nick. Sometimes it's rather satisfying to see terrible people meet their grisly ends. And that particular employer was the worst.
He was terrible. He needed it. Yeah,
he needed it. I love
his bargain. The whole denial, bargaining anger thing they did with him was great. Him trying to bargain his way out of that wall was fantastic. There's also a couple big... The reveal of what the texting was.
Mm-hmm.
So the other two guys on my TV podcast hated that, thought that was stupid.
Really?
I loved it. I thought it was such a great reveal, and it plays into what they were doing with Madeline all the way through.
This was the texting from Lenore?
From Lenore, yes.
I remember what it was, and I won't say what it was, but like, what was... Why was she doing it though?
Because the AI was busted. The AI didn't work.
Oh, because it was an AI thing specifically. Yep. Yeah, no, that's very clever.
I thought so too.
You know, I will say this though. This is the episode where, and this has happened before with Flanagan and stuff for me, I had some criticisms because I felt like there was a little speechifying-y, which is sometimes a thing he does. Yep. His character sometimes monologue. And I often like to hear it, but it's a little on the nose sometimes, and it can sound a little preachy at times.
Incorrect. This was perfect.
And I thought that in some of the stuff that where Mary McDonnell is that her name as Madeline is saying, like talking about the sins of what they have done, she and Roderick, when they think their end is near. I thought that led to some stuff that sounded a little preachy. But one thing I did appreciate without getting too much into this was how, like, in a lot of ways, awful and unrepentant they were. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is an accurate representation of, I think, how these souls have become dead things for people who are extremely wealthy and I think it's all but inevitable. I think you can be, even be a very good person, and be this will happen to you eventually. You'll be surrounded by so many yes men that your worldview will become distorted.
Right.
Yep.
Also, this episode does have that Mark Hamill and Carlo Gugino scene.
Oh man,
where
quite the scene stealer moment.
What a great moment that was. Yeah,
we were all happy to see Mark Hamill get these moments, and he's plays such a gravelly voiced character who doesn't show a lot of emotion. That's his whole thing.
Yeah.
But he still gets these amazing scenes, and this is the best of them.
He has a commanding presence.
Here he is face to face with the force that we know is responsible for the destruction of the children of the Usher family, and what happens to him is different. And I don't want to say
he outright tries to kill her at the very beginning of the scene.
Oh, right.
Right. Well, the thing I really loved about this is not only is it a great scene for him, but Carlo Gugino, who has a ton of great scenes throughout this, it's one of her best.
Yeah.
Her sitting down with the guy, her sort of approval, she's like, no, you're the angel of death. I love it. Like, the two of them are very similar. They're doing very similar things for different reasons.
She is just like, you know, it is never quite specified, and I don't believe there's any one specific post story that it's from. It's the conceit of the show, though, that... and I believe, I'm right now reading the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, which I know at least will touch on the story he told about his traveling.
Right.
And presumably some atrocity or some strange thing that happens. I don't know how close the book is to the story that he told. But
I would imagine it would be...
Do you remember the part, Randy, where she says that she was watching and she was like the aurora above him or something like that?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this is like... You know, there was a sense, oh, is she the devil? And I was like, I felt like it's beyond that. It felt more elemental, more like a primal kind of pagan spirit or something like that had been around on Earth for millennia. And it has maybe a certain kind of interest in humans, but it's has kind of the cruelty of nature that nature is. You know, not one of these things where everything in nature is benevolent, but there is a certain cruelty, or at the very least, at least indifference.
Yeah.
And... I felt like I didn't need her specifics explained, so that was not a big issue.
I'm glad they didn't. I think it was interesting, though, that basically she's talking to him about, like, all the stuff that he has clearly never told a single soul ever.
Yeah.
And so he knows she's for real. If he wasn't already convinced by the fact that he killed her and she got right back up.
Yeah, that was a really good sequence.
Yeah. The bit where she's like, there's that sort of kind of thing you get from like gods like Loki and some of the stuff where basically she's not mad that he tried to kill her. She's amused.
Right.
She's like, that was cute. I like that.
This is a great vehicle for Carlo Gugino.
Yeah. She's probably the best she'll get in her life, I think.
I mean, she's definitely done great roles.
She's had phenomenal roles.
But here she gets to play so many different parts and like show... she got to do a lot of makeup and just... She seemed to be having a blast.
Well,
and
it's
really
an ultimate
shows.
Way to play the villain, because every role she was playing had some villainous turn in it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so you got to try out a bunch of different villains.
But every person as well.
She was like somebody running a animal shelter. She was a security guard. She was all these things.
Or a patient.
And yet she also got to be very scary and intimidating time. And she got to basically be the devil in the Deal with the Devil stories.
Mm-hmm. And the other person in this is Bruce Greenwood for me. I mean, not only does he get the most screen time, he just is one of those actors that's very personable, very kind of like... He's a horrible human being, but I still like him.
Yeah. he made you kind of want to hope for redemption.
Yeah.
You know, I think we talked about this. The also great actor, Frank Langella, was fired from the set because he made some creepy old man sexist comments or something like that, and they weren't having it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, come on, we used to always get away with that. And I think they were like, nope. And so they replaced him with Bruce Greenwood, and Bruce Greenwood acts like gives the performance of a lifetime.
Honestly... Langella would have played this completely differently and it wouldn't have worked as well. Greenwood was a better call.
I think he was a better call.
Yeah.
But also, Greenwood and Carl Lumley together. Lumley also got to really shine here.
Yep. Yeah. This has, in a lot of ways, things people like about whenever you have a classic villain and hero, a Moriarty versus Sherlock Holmes, a Batman Joker, when you get to see them sort of just chew scenery and talk to each other, and every episode had that.
Yep.
And also Zach Guilford, who plays the young version of Roderick, is
and
really
who's responsible
good.
For giving us make a lot of him sympathetic. We see him younger and more fresh faced,
dealing with like a first wife and sort of like being a good person.
Yeah. Or at least flirting with it.
Flirting with it, yes.
The this final episode has some, arguably some of their very darkest material, and also some interesting little moments of hope in it, yeah. And sort of a few sort of happier endings for some people.
I was extremely
sort of
happy with this series.
It's a pretty good note to go out on for Flanagan's Netflix ride, which has been, basically he's got like, what, three, or is it four?
Four.
Really big ones. And then you could argue a Midnight Club if you want.
Yeah, but that's like a footnote.
That's like more of a footnote, and yeah, he has Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Blind Manor, Midnight Mass, and now Fall of the House of Usher.
But the Midnight Club definitely gave us some actors that are in this who plays like Prospero.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Juno.
And Juno.
Was in there.
Yeah, she's great here. And who did he bring in? He brought in the guy from Clive from iZombie, who's probably not part of the crew.
No, but he's now
and
going to be.
And he was great. I'm really curious who all these people are going to play in the Dark Tower series. Because you know that's next.
It's always fun. By the way, as terrible as who's the guy who's Elliot in E.T.?
Thomas Gibson? Henry Thomas?
Henry Thomas.
Okay. Although he's a terrible person, I thought he did a great job as that character. Mm-hmm. Like, he's watching him snort coke and, like, be a weirdo. Mm-hmm. He's almost like Crispin Glover, a version of that when he's at his worst.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see it early on, and then he kind of becomes it. Yeah. So good job for him, too.
Well, it's like the complete opposite of his character from Hill House.
Yeah, yeah. He was the trying his best dad.
Yeah. And I think this may be the first time we've seen him do the turn of, like,
much more used to him. Because he was, like, a kindly priest in the Ouija movie that they did.
He was good in that.
He was good. This is a... that he was actually one of the most awful people in it. Was good stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, Dave, you saw The Fog.
Yeah, this is a movie that we might have talked about before. We probably talked about it when you...
Yeah.
Didn't you watch it recently, Nick?
I did.
So I'm not going to do the sort of big walkthrough, but the circumstances were unique and may still be available, maybe not, I don't know. But one of our local drive-in theater, Blue Starlight, I have not been to those. I've actually never been to a drive-in theater.
Hmm.
I grew up in an era when
never,
I guess
really?
That never ever.
Oh. I haven't either.
When you one might have in the like say the 80s, but yeah, it was just like, you know, I went to plenty of movies, but just we didn't do the drive-in thing. And so I still have it, but they have a little unrelated theater over near in the
Wait,
Mueller
this wasn't
area.
A drive-in?
Nope.
This is
the forest screen.
Oh, I thought you still drove up to it though.
I mean, you do drive to a field and walk.
But then
through,
you get out. Okay,
then you get out and you...
I thought you were in your cars in the little foresty area.
No, we walked to a clearing. Hold that thought. Okay. Nick. Hold that thought. I will say it is not well marked.
Okay,
you're driving like sort of near like the in the Mueller area, like not too far from the was it like the. There's an Alamo over there in that shopping center.
Yeah.
And you're kind of driving through the residential area, and there's a thing where it looks like you just enter into an empty parking lot. And I was like, it can't possibly be here. There's no lights anywhere. And then I pull into the parking lot, and I was like, oh, you know what? At the very end, it looks like there might be a sign. And sure enough, it says Blue Starlight, and there's an arrow.
Okay.
And so I follow it through this little, very short forested path that's very thin to drive through. And then I enter into, like, a grassy parking like lot. Which itself, again, no lights, and there was nobody around and stuff, but I was like, wait, no, there is somebody, and they've turned on a flashlight now, and they are giving directions, and then I did see that there was like a little clearing in the woods, which, by the way, you're actually very close to like a residential area and highways and stuff, because you can hear a little bit of traffic here and there. So it wasn't like we're out in the middle of the woods in like a deep, dark forest. It's a little forested area in a residential community, but it is like blocked off from a little bit from everything else. So you get out and they had a little trail you walk that's just like 20 feet that has like Christmas lights kind of haphazardly strewn about. But there it is lit up and you're like, okay, there is now a little clearing you get to where there's seats and a little concession stand and a screen set up. And the seats, as you were about to say, Nick, are include some fold-up chairs and things like that, but also a, like, clearly removed from a car seats, which are perfect for two. And because it was a little chilly that night, which was actually perfect for the kind of the yeah, screening, okay. It's supposed to be a little bit cold in Antonio Bay.
Yep.
A little chilly that night. And the big thing was to both see it outdoors, but also they had live fog at the fog. So that during the sequences where the mariners and stuff would rise up and you had the actual fog sequences, they turned on their fog machine. I don't know how it was as quiet as it was. A lot of times those have like a little pump or generator, but I didn't hear it. And I want to say sometimes the wind cooperated and it blew just perfectly across the screen, especially in the ending scenes, which were the key ones. But every once in a while, I would notice like a little fog, like off to my left or something like that. And it didn't quite like say go around to the screen area, but it was really actually a very fun experience. I think there was maybe like a dozen people there, probably all Carpenter fan, you know, and horror nerds. And The Fog is one of my favorite John Carpenter movies. It's like it's actually the most watched one I think I have of his. It's got Janet Leigh in it with her daughter Jamie Lee Curtis. Yep. And regular player. God, what's the dude who's the Jamie Lee Curtis hooks up with?
Scott.
No.
No.
He's the dude who's also in Halloween 3.
Yeah, which we'll talk about.
But and then of course Adrian Barbeau is the lighthouse keeper, and it's got all the things I like: scary ghosts, fog, lighthouses, eerie small towns.
Tom Atkins,
yeah. Anyway, if it is still running, I recommend trying to catch it. Just know you're going to want to like just drive slowly in the parking areas. You'll get there.
You might feel like you're about to get killed.
Even as I was sitting there, I was like, is this like a cult thing? And like the thing.
You know, you've watched too many horror movies.
It was a little bit weird, but you know, the guy who was there, who I believe owns the Blue Starlight, and this is like more of his little side project that he wanted to do to have some spooky forest movies and stuff like that. He indicated that they may only be doing this for a few more months, and then it's purely the drive-in. So even if you don't do this one, watch for other ones if you like the idea of the experience and try and catch one, because it may be not too much longer for this world. But anyway, good times.
Nick, you were going to talk about Trick or Treat, which you rewatched.
Yes.
Which we have all enjoyed.
This might be my favorite of the more recent Halloween movies. I came to it very late. I came to it, like, maybe not last year, but the year before.
Okay. Oh, well, you I was thinking I was later than you.
No. I'd never watched it.
So this never got released in theaters. Well, it did eventually.
It eventually did, but originally it was
just like...
I don't know if it was a direct-to-home video or whatever it was. It did not see a
very limited release, and it was 2007.
Yeah, it never got released to theaters originally.
Which means we're not far. We're a few years out from its 20th anniversary.
Well, they've also talked about doing, like, a sequel to it.
Right.
But this is sort of a Halloween vignette horror.
Like an anthology.
Anthology movie.
With a framing story, just like a lot of those anthology stories have.
But it's kind of a weird anthology because it all blends together. There's not like a real separation of stories.
I mean, there is, but then you'll see them overlapping.
Yeah, because I think my favorite one is the... he's in The Good Fight and The Good Wife.
Dylan Baker. Dylan Baker is phenomenal.
As the serial killer high school... he's like...
He's the vice principal of
elementary school or something. And yes, he apparently kills people with his young son.
Yeah.
It is a dark little romp. All of these are kind of all
darkly humorous, yeah.
And they're all framed by Sam, which is kind of like the avatar of Halloween.
Scary pumpkin-headed boy who will kind of, if you do the kind of rules of Halloween wrong, if you talk shit about Halloween
or take down your decorations on Halloween.
Yeah, you go against the experience, you'll get knifed, you know, he'll get you. He is a fun new Halloween character.
Yeah.
Is he based on Sam Hain? Is that kind of like the...
That's his full name, yes. Which, okay. for people cringing right now, would be more actually pronounced Samhain. But yes, every American in existence has mispronounced it as Sam Hain, and so they went ahead and said, like, that's our character, Sam.
Hey, I blame the real Ghostbusters, which actually used Sam Hain.
It's true.
They should sue Trick or Treat as the original creators. What else? There's the...
the bust story about the kids who the parents no longer wanted, so they drove into the lake.
Yep.
The bus driver played.
Is that the one that has what's her name, Anna Paquin?
No, that's the werewolf, story.
Right.
The bus driver ends up being Brian Cox, who now is an older kind of curmudgeonly hater of Halloween.
Yep.
His little detente with Sam is quite amusing.
Yep.
This movie is
like. It's one of those things, like, the first time I saw it, I was like, that's fine, it's good, it's not amazing, but I kind of see why people liked it. Mm-hmm. I had to see it a second time to kind of really, for it to grow on me.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I really like it. And it's, like, feels, it's like, literally set on Halloween.
Yep.
It's extremely Halloween-y, so if you're looking for something that has the vibe of Halloween, but don't want to watch Halloween.
And I really think it's, I know this is kind of a dirty word, but it's fun. It really is.
I love Trick or Treat.
It's darkly funny. And it has a lot of dark humor in it.
Well, Trick or Treat leads me to what I watched, which is Halloween 3.
Season of the Witch.
Because I think Trick or Treat is what Halloween should have become.
In some ways.
An anthology series of different Halloween...
Let them get to even a second Trick or Treat.
Look, here's the thing. Halloween is the perfect name for a yearly movie that is a spooky movie about a different scary story.
That's what Carpenter wanted.
Instead, it's about this dumb guy in a mask killing a bunch of co-eds.
And I think we've talked about this before, but the very quick version of is that Carpenter originally did want Halloween to be a series that every year would just have some new spooky thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if it was always going to be set on Halloween, but probably.
Yeah.
And then Halloween, the first Halloween did so well, they're like, you've got to make a sequel, bro, here's some money.
And he
did it and killed off Mike Myers.
My point being that John Carpenter is smarter than the studios.
Well, that would almost certainly be true.
So,
Actually, arguably, they have done well with Michael Myers.
I was going to say, I take issue because I do like Michael Myers. He might actually be one of my favorite Halloween creatures.
I got no love for slashers. Even Ghostface. I don't love slashers. So.
It is an even balance right here because we know Serena, who is out not in this room, but she's also a fan. So it's her and Nick against you and me, Randy.
All right, but they're slasher fans. They're going to kill us both.
They're going to slash us.
Yeah, they're going to slash us.
Anyway, so Carpenter did that, and he was like, okay, all done. Now I will start funding my weird new movies, the first of which was Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is now actually has for, I would say, at least 10 years or more been experiencing a bit of a renaissance as people rediscover it and like it.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, like, if you're a big Michael Myers fan, sometimes you're like, oh, that's the one that sucks because there's no Michael Myers. And it's also, it's a weird-ass movie.
It's a weird-ass movie.
Tell us about the weird-ass movie.
So this is way more like Carpenter sci-fi than it is horror in a lot of ways. Like, there are robots.
Yep.
There's a crazy scheme in which kids' masks are going to turn their brains into jello and turn them into bugs and snakes.
Yep. Big druidic sacrifice stuff.
Using Stonehenge magic.
The titular witch is, in fact, Dan O'Hurley.
Yes. Yeah. That is true.
He gets to choose some scenery towards the end.
And, although, I'll say this. You don't know quite about the sci-fi-ish elements until, I would say, the last quarter of the movie.
Right.
At first, it's just like... There's a bunch of weird stuff going on.
Weird, like, emotionless people.
Emotionless killers.
Because it opens up with a man being chased.
Yep.
Then goes to the hospital and then gets killed in the hospital.
Right. But that chase, but it opens very strong because, like,
the chase is great.
The guy's chasing him and he, like, manages to stop him by grabbing the block off a car. He pulls it, the guy doesn't see it, and the car, like, crushes the robot guy.
Yes. It's a memorable sequence. In fact, I love that whole scene and the sort of suspense of it when he's, like, hiding in, like, that sort of junkyard area, and the bad guy's car goes past, and then he's just, like, he just holds in place, and then the car, a few seconds later, pulls back, and you're like, oh, shit.
Well, the whole thing feels very of its era. It feels to me like Phantasm, like Warriors, weirdly in some ways, like it feels like those movies to me. It has a 80s pacing and style. I was not as in love with this as either of y'all. I don't believe I wound up thinking that's all right. I'm glad I saw it, but it was a lot of fun to finally see.
Oddly enough, and like that may be where you land, and that's fine. Not everybody has to like Halloween 3, but I also think at some point, perhaps revisit it. Possibly with me, because I always need to see it again. and I think you might change warm a little bit to it.
It does feature a two-fisted doctor. And I was going to
say Tom Atkins.
Man, this guy does okay in his Carpenter movies, hooking up with Jamie Lee Curtis in that one. A chick half his age in this one. But yes, he's a doctor who has some weird stuff happen at his hospital, and so he's like, I better investigate this. Mm-hmm. In the style of like kind of 80s characters, yep. It was very much a trope.
And that leads to a small town, like that's like a distributor for
these masks.
It was the
first time I was aware of like a town that was like a corporate town. Mm-hmm.
With all of its surveillance cameras.
Yeah, that was also
some of
something
stuff was like ahead of its time.
Yeah. Part of it is also, I really like how this is filmed. I was mentioning to you, Randy, this is although Carpenter only produced this, he didn't direct it.
Yep.
But it had a frequently collaborating director of photography, Dean Cundey, who is a guy who is like, he worked with Carpenter a ton. Like, he did, like, I think, The Fog and The Thing and maybe even Halloween and stuff like that. It's just, mm-hmm. like, many, many of his 80s movies. But he also hit some of the biggest movies of all time. Jurassic Park, Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, like all of those movies. So there's some really beautiful shots in that small town, some great eerie stuff.
Yeah. This definitely has the thumbprint of Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. I thought it does.
And he did the music.
Yeah, he did the music, which is a lot of synth, and his kind of...
Oh, man, I love that soundtrack.
There were a couple of beats I was like, I think lingered a little too long, and I know you disagreed, Dave. I know you do.
We'll talk about this later. there was one of the
things. But I definitely enjoyed this movie, because I rewatched it just recently.
The stuff that I would equate it with would be something a little bit more like Prince of Darkness, which has that sort of weird quantum physics connection. Yeah. So if you want a little bit of that John Carpenter, or The Thing, that has a little bit of a sci-fi element to its horror, you know, one to check out.
Yeah.
But it's weird. Just know it's going to be weird when you're going in.
Nick, you've been watching some classic horror?
I did. Some of this on the recommendation of Dave, because he talked about it a little while ago. One is The Most Dangerous Game.
Right. This is like a 1930s movie.
1932 is when it hit. I'm not going to look up any of the actors because I'm...
And, like, Al Capone was off menacing people when this movie hit.
But this is kind of about hunting humans. Yeah. And about
adapting a famous story.
Yeah. But it's about a major hunter who's on a ship that's coming close to this island, and it gets swept up, kills everybody but him, and he kind of randomly runs across this big, giant castle, palace, whatever you want to call it, that is run by a Cossack.
A madman.
A mad Cossack.
Yeah. But he's also a gentlemanly villain.
You rightly said that this could be like the progenitor of Dr. Doom.
Right.
He is very kind of like that stately, but slightly honorable, but slightly
Oh, you're my guest.
Right.
But, I wouldn't conceive of having you leave just yet. Not before I'd had entertained you or whatever.
And he gets there and deals with this person, finds a couple people who have crash landed prior to who have not
been
rescued.
They've been there like a few weeks and they're like...
It's like a brother and sister.
They're like, have you not gotten like the generator up running again to get a call out for help?
The sister is very kind of dubious of the situation. The brother is a lech who is like drunk half
the
time.
Right, he's just happy to be here partying at the council.
He's playing the organ that the guy, the big bad, has, and is just kind of like having a good time until he gets hunted.
Yep.
Which is the big thing.
I like a lot of the scenes in this movie where no one, they are suspecting what happens to the people on this island, but they can't come out and say it. They don't want to press the issue because they're in a weak spot.
Yeah.
And this guy could be dangerous, they know. But they're kind of pushing it a little bit. In the conversations with them, they're kind of like, hey, really like if we could get that boat fixed.
But for a 1930s movie, I was definitely kind of... There were some great shots. I felt like the island itself has a great atmosphere.
Yeah. It feels like a place you can visit.
Yeah, and I don't know if I want to visit it.
A set-like thing at times. It'd be cool to go to one of those, like, you know...
His castle is cool.
Like, the Most Dangerous Game experience, like at an amusement park.
Yeah.
Where you would actually go and have dinner there. It would be like a dining experience. And then, when you're all full and stuff, he chases you.
But he's honorable. He gives you at least a half a day head start and gives you food and a knife and...
Yep. little you know, they always seem honorable, but then out he comes, rolls with, like, his, like, hunting rifle and dogs and stuff.
And, like, a group of individual hunters that work with him. And
as I recall, like, do you get to see the main dude, the lead, the heroic lead, come up with some clever ways to get out of his...
He definitely comes up with some traps and things like that, which are really cool.
Yeah, I always like to see the sort of ingenuity of whoever's being hunted.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed this. I went on a Vincent Price marathon.
Sure.
And I watched the original House on Haunted Hill, which I believe is from 1952, yeah. I want to say, or it's maybe 15.
Made by William Castle, the guy who kind of famously had, like, the novelty experience, like, in some of his movies. Like, you would go into a theater, and during the scary part, your seat would, like, vibrate or buzz or whatever to freak you out. Like, he was, like, quite the showman. But like, this is a movie I actually really like. I like the remake they did in the 90s.
I love the remake. And that's a weird thing to say, because it's a little pop. It's definitely more...
It's like pop horror.
Pop horror. Jeffrey Rush does an amazing job. But you see kind of, like, the inklings of that movie, what they took from this one to get to that.
For sure. It's the basics are all there. But it has, like, it has the same sort of, what, bickering couple who would kind of like to murder
each
other.
Played by Vincent Price and Carol Emhart.
And the same, the challenge, I love the premise of this movie. It's one of those spend a night in a haunted house, right?
It's his wife's birthday, and he's throwing her a birthday party and invites five random individuals that have nothing to do with her. He has his reasons for it because he, too, is not really fond of his wife. And I like that it's just a bickering couple trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the basis for this entire movie. The ghosts are kind of, like, on the edges.
Right.
And it's also just kind of like the spookiness.
There are some cheap special effects in this, but a few of them, like the wild-eyed, wild-haired person that you see at one point.
Yes. I mean, there's some
actually
fun
creepy looking.
It is. But Vincent Price is just selling the hell out of this movie, and he and his kind of classic Vincent Price persona of... being this killer,
a man of leisure, but who looks who does seem like he could have you killed at any given moment.
Yes, this was a lot of fun. This was from 1959, the people there get $10,000 if they can spend the night. And I'm like, man, the other one, I think it was it like $1 million each? They definitely inflation happened.
You gotta work up. Honestly, if today, this very day, I was still only offered $10,000 to do it, I would do it. I would go into Murder House.
All right. Interesting.
Dave's a skeptic. That's how he's going to get murdered.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
By ghosts.
And then I watched...
my thing is, Randy, I just won't explore the house. I'll be like, I'm pretty comfy on the couch.
The ghosts will come find you, Dave.
No, I'll be like, I'm going to put some stuff in front of these doors. Ghosts aren't real. Nothing's going to happen.
And then I watched another Vincent Price, The Mask of the Red Death, which is the Roger Corman 1964 movie.
Roger Corman, his name is somewhat synonymous with sort of like cheaply made movies.
Yeah.
But among the stuff that is most admired from him, which he does have that side of him too, is he did like the Poe cycle of movies where he adapted and expanded on a bunch of Edgar Allan Poe movies.
Yeah, and the conceit of this one is, I'm just going to read the quick blurb because it's one sentence essentially. A European prince terrorizes the local peasantry while using his castle as a refuge against the Red Death, plague that stalks the land. It's a very simple premise.
Yep.
Vincent Price gets to be awful. I mean, he basically tortures, has people murdered, because he's a Satanist.
Yeah, this was the burgeoning era of the satanic panic.
But it's kind of the debauchery and the insanity and kind of the spectacle, because it's the colors in it are very wild and vivid, and I think the sets are all really cool. His castle is just kind of that weird vibe to it. You are given a few heroes to root for, specifically a woman and her soon-to-be-wed husband and her father.
Mm-hmm.
They might not all make it, because this is one of those things.
Gotta help a few people.
But I kind of like the conceit that the Red Death is I mean, not unlike what we saw in Fall of the House of Usher. I mean, that was the second episode. That's very much an homage to what this story homages about a kind of a plague inhabited by a person that visits upon the world and this prince who thinks he's hot shit.
It fulfills a lot of the highest callings of horror, which is to say, some bad people get punished, but also there's a little bit of realism in the sense of, oh, several innocents have to die along the way, too.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was quite good.
So I'll interrupt real quick to mention that I watched a couple of movies that Nick has seen, or at least I think you've seen both of them. Mm-hmm. One of them is on your movie list, which is Bodies, Bodies, Bodies.
Yep. I've seen it. I liked it.
Dave, did you see Bodies, Bodies, Bodies?
Nope.
So this is, it is in Florida? Is it in Florida?
I believe that is correct.
It's like this big mansion, these snotty rich 20-somethings. Mm-hmm. Pete Davis, it's his parents' house. It's him.
Oh, right. I remember the trailers for this now.
His, like, his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend, or ex, is like, the oldest friend, who is a lesbian, is bringing her new girlfriend with her. And who seems to be on the outs with all the other people.
Yep.
And a couple other women and a guy that they just met. Played by Lee Pace. That's who that was. They all get together in this house for a hurricane party. They know a hurricane's coming.
Yep.
And they're gonna play this
Power's
game.
Out.
Power's, well, it's probably going first. But,
oh, right.
So they're gonna play Bodies, 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 which is a game where basically one person is secretly the killer. And then the lights go, they turn the lights out, and the killer touches someone, and that person has to be dead. And then they have to guess who the killer is. It's like werewolf or one of those things. Only very early on, Pete Davidson gets killed.
Yep.
He shows up at the window after the hurricane has started. He's like, his throat's been cut, and there's like a real murderer among them.
And so I can go ahead and take a guess. It's Kanye.
So the whole movie is these awful 20-somethings.
Yep.
Bickering with each other, trying to figure out who killed Pete Davidson,
spiraling,
and who's the killer. And I really enjoyed it. It was fun. I was like, oh, this is kind of a fun movie. It's all right. And then when you get to the ending, they reveal who the actual killer is. The whole thing went up a star. I was like, that's amazing.
Don't tell me.
It's got a great ending.
It does.
So worth seeing. The other one I watched was Final Girls. Have you seen this one?
Yeah, I have.
So I saw this one about 3 years ago and somehow completely forgot it, which is great because it meant I get to see it again for the first time.
Yep.
This is super good. It is Vera Farmiga's daughter is the lead.
Tasia Farmiga.
And her playing her mom is Malin Ackerman, who you might know as Silk Spectre from Watchmen. Among other things.
Yeah.
But basically, this sort of opens, and her mom is an actress who got sort of pigeonholed because she did this movie, this 80s slasher movie called Camp Bloodbath or something.
Yeah,
like
something
that.
I can't remember the name of it.
And it's supposed to be the granddaddy of slasher movies, like before Friday the 13th, all that kind of thing.
Okay.
And so they show you the trailer for it, and then she and her mom, are like, you know, her mom's like a struggling actress and she's a teenager and she's like the adult in the relationship. And things happen and she and her friends go to a revival of this movie and they wind up using a machete, which may or may not be magical, to slash their way into the movie.
Okay.
So they are now in the 80s movie Camp Bloodbath or whatever it is. And they know what's going to happen, sort of. And they know that the only way to get out of this is for the final girl to kill this serial killer. And there's a lot of great meta stuff where they're like, at the beginning when they don't know what's going on, the van pulls up, this hippie van, the VW van full of these camp counselors, pulls up next to them and is like, hey, do you guys know the way to the camp? They're like, no, we don't. Okay. And then they drive off. And then the thing that puts up a thing says 92 minutes later, and they start pulling again because basically the film is running around them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then so eventually they join, they go to the camp, they're like participating in the movie, they're changing things. Mm-hmm. It's very funny, very clever. It's got Adam Devine is in it. He plays a perfect, like, their jock douchebag. I forget who, Ali Shawkat from Arrested Development is in there. Yep. It is a ton of fun. I forgot just how much fun this movie was.
If you like the more recent Totally Killer, this is definitely one to watch.
This fits in with, like, Tucker and Dale versus Evil and that kind of stuff.
You know, there's actually been a lot of pretty good horror movies that are essentially somewhat meta-contextual and kind of pop, you know, like Scream would obviously fall into that, but also Cabin in the Woods and stuff like that. Like, it's a pretty solid subgenre.
I'm going to talk about You Might Be the Killer, which is in the same vein. It's a sort of a horror comedy, but I just handed that off to Nick. I'm going to wait till he watches it.
Yeah, I want to watch this. I'll probably end up watching it tonight.
Nick, you also were going to mention some of the other. So you also watched some of their like more modern horror.
So yeah,
closer to modern than Mask of the Red Death.
Anyway. Correct. So I watched The Strangers, which is a home invasion film. With Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler.
Okay.
This is a subgenre of horror that I don't like.
But you don't like to just see people terrorized and tortured?
Correct. It's not my most favorite thing. Part of it is because it feels more real than a lot of other horror genres can be.
Because on our worst fears. Arguably, I feel like, and this is, I think, what the Purge movies figured out, as a genre, it's kind of like xenophobic and imagines the worst possible thing is that your comfortable house could be upset by people from the outside.
But this one kind of gets an exception for me because I think it's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
I think the relationship between Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman is very real and kind of better executed than a lot of the other just kind of like slasher home invasion where you don't give a shit about anyone.
Right.
They are basically coming home from a wedding. They're staying at like a family friend's house. They get home at 3 a.m. They're at odds with each other because
I'm mad at these home invaders just for interrupting somebody when they're going to clearly be tired.
Well, yeah, he had proposed to her. She turned him down. So there's that kind of animosity between the two, but also they still love each other. There's just some like weird kind of non-connection on that point.
Right.
And then there's a knock at the door.
Yep.
And somebody is looking for Tamara. And that's when things start to go downhill.
Okay.
There's twists and turns in it. There's a level of realism that it feels a little more better done and not kind of like, oh, it's just kind of they're doing this for the sake of the movie, or I don't know. It's a good horror movie. I think it's better than I think the Rotten Tomatoes is at like 40 or. But regardless,
horror movies do tend to get the harsh reviews.
It's true. Yeah.
I know there's about to start like a revival of this. I know there was a sequel that was supposed to be awful, which I didn't watch, and they're supposed to do like a prequel ish to it. So we'll see if
is this a remake of a European film or something.
I don't think so. I think this was a just a standalone thing, as far as I know.
Which one is this? The Strangers.
Okay. It is not that one that you're talking. That has been.
But
remade.
I feel like there was a few invasion movies.
And then the other one, which I had not seen in a couple of decades, which is David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Yep.
I had forgotten how good this movie is. The level of body horror in a David Cronenberg movie is always disconcerting, because that's just what he does. And he does it extremely well, probably the best that anybody does, because it's so disgusting.
As you're like, oh, I want to feel less comfortable in my skin than I already do.
Because Jeff Goldblum's transformation into a human fly man, or Brundlefly, as he likes to call himself, is terrifying.
Well, yeah, what of course separates this apart from the original movie, where literally like kind of like an arm and the head swapped on a human and a fly. So a fly got a little tiny human head and a weird like human arm, and a man got a big old creepy giant fly head and a creepy like
and
fly,
this,
fly paw.
This is a fusion. So right.
And not one that happens immediately.
No, it is a gradual.
It's like, oh, well, it was just a little bit of fly DNA inside his human thing. So he's, you know, next day he's fine.
And I feel like this is peak Gina Davis and peak Jeff Goldblum. They are at like the height of their abilities.
I saw an article the other day showing about this that basically there's one of those Cinema Society things. Basically, like that they had to fight for the Cronenberg had to fight for Goldblum.
Really,
the makeup people were like he's going to be so much work to like do makeup for because of his weird angular face.
Yeah,
and then they had to fight Then Cronenberg wasn't sure about Gina Davis, who was Goldblum's girlfriend at the time.
Oh.
And so he's like, yeah. And then they tested her, and she's like, no, she was the best test.
Oh,
so, yeah, like, they
their
almost
chemistry
wasn't
is
the two
great.
Of them. Yeah.
And
it
I
almost
guess,
wasn't the two of them.
I guess that makes sense if they were actual off-screen a couple at that point. Because
I think I've had that happen before, and that doesn't come off well on screen because they don't want to like put their public life exactly out there.
But from basically
their private life, I mean,
like minute one when they're at a kind of party,
like an expo,
he's kind of like being Jeff Goldblum a little bit, like kind of wandering around the room, and she's a reporter looking for her next story.
He kind of casually says, she's like, what are you all about? And he's like, oh, it's just an invention that'll change the world.
And she's like, well, what is it? And he's like, well, let me show you. And it's just, there's a chemistry. It's really, they have just an amazing presence together. And their relationship grows in this in a rather kind of, usual way. I mean, they fall in love over the course of a couple of weeks and months as he's sort of trying to figure out his teleportation transport abilities.
It's not exactly a love triangle, but there is a complication in the fact that her boss, I believe the editor of the magazine she works for, which would be the equivalent of something like Omni or something is her ex. And
wanting to let go.
He's a skeevy dude in many ways, classic line in this when she's like, "Hey, let this go." She's like, "I'm onto something big here," and he's like, "What? His cock?"
Yep. there are a couple super memorable lines in this.
It's a well-written horror movie that has an interestingly intimate view of like two people, and then falls into this as he begins breaking down, his body begins changing, and at first it's like weird sores and things in his fingernails.
Well, first it's
off.
Nothing, and he thinks he's been purified, and it's like the egotistical nature of his mind is like personified to like nth degrees, and then he starts like doing gymnastics, like he feels like he is at the peak of his body,
right?
And then things start to go down.
I think the idea is like it gives him like he's a sort of low confidence nerdy dude, and the sort of I guess animalistic focus, that insectoid focus on survival and things like that, kind of gets into him, and that's why it's like he got superpowers and everything's cool. He's kind of stronger and faster now. And he's feeling energized.
And he wants her to do the transport.
Yeah.
And he keeps pushing it. She is not having it because she doesn't think it's safe.
Yeah.
And, she's proven correct.
this is a genuinely fairly disturbing movie.
But I think it's made even more disturbing by the ending.
Yeah, the ending is rough.
The ending
is
very
rough.
There's
a high level of violence in it. And the violence is not like just like weird transformations or something like that. It's actually pretty, disturbing violence.
Yeah, it is. But it may be Cronenberg's best movie.
I mean, it probably is for me. I'm trying to have to kind of think about what his other big ones are. Did he do Crash, the one that was based on the 60s book about people who get off on having car crashes? And
I don't think that was him. Because does that have? I don't think that has like body horror. Like all.
Oh, it does. It absolutely
does.
And he doesn't only do body horror. He has some other movies that are not body horror. But that one has some people who are wearing like leg braces and things like that, and I think a person who even lost a leg in an accident. And there's like, oh, but that is a different. I forgot. There's the other racism is bad crash movie.
Yes, it's not that movie.
Cronenberg is the guy, which I need to watch The Dead Zone.
You know what? The Dead Zone is just okay.
But he also is the guy who did Naked Lunch and Existence and Dead Ringers and Scanners.
Crash is a 1996 Canadian erotic thriller film written, produced, and directed by David Cronenberg.
Yep.
Based on J.G. Ballard's 1973 novel of the same name.
That's a messed up movie.
It is a messed up movie. But I thought it was really good. And you know what? That one has people desperate to find love and connection in it, too. This is interesting to see that as not just like, oh, isn't it gross when our bodies do things we don't like and isn't that scary? But he also has, things about alienation and people trying to connect.
Yeah.
Videodrome, I have not seen, but I believe has elements of that, as well as, obviously, criticism of, like, TV culture and stuff.
Just saying, this is on HBO Max. People should, if they haven't watched it, watched it in a while.
The Fly is the real deal.
It is.
Yeah. And then Us, you rewatched Us.
Oh, yeah. Dave and I had a double feature last night.
The thematic themed around a you can't trust the people around you kind of vibe.
So we opened with the 78
I think 78.
Version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm.
Headlined by Donald Sutherland.
But also featuring Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum.
Leonard Nimoy.
And a weird appearance by Robert Duvall in the opening 30 seconds. As a priest.
On a swing set. Yes, literally there is just a, like, was it like a little parochial school or something like that?
Yeah.
And in the background there is a priest who was on a swing set, and Nick was like, God, that guy looks like Robert Duvall. And I was like, well, since I know that character has no role in this, I'm like, there's no way that's Robert Duvall for like 2 seconds as a priest on a swing set. And it was.
This is a dark movie.
It is, but it isn't.
It
isn't that dark. It's not like it's the grim dark throughout.
Yeah,
it has a feeling of mystery and eerie discovery.
Yes.
But it does tell you right from the beginning what these creatures are, that this is an extraterrestrial life form that you see on the planet. And, you know, special effects, visual optical and practical effects of the era, which might be a little limited, but I thought were pretty good showing these, like, what looked like little weird microscopic life and plant life on another world that then starts to sort of have weird little blooms that kind of go up into the air, like maybe they have gas pods or something like that, and begin drifting through space.
Yeah, in my brain, reminiscent of, like, those flowers that kind of, like, do the spore. Like, you blow on them and they spread out. I forget
dandelions?
What they're... Dandelions.
Yeah.
Kind of like that. Kind of a weird kind of... Because there's all kind of, like, vegetation and plant stuff throughout this.
And then the soundscape-wise, there's an eerie kind of, like, sonogram-type sound effect that they use repeatedly with it. And you see them falling to Earth and then, like... There's some creepy close-ups of plants where you see them. It's almost like little parasitic vines that come out from these and detach to other plants. And then you see they have their own weird little flowering version.
Yep.
And then there's like a... Because this takes place in San Francisco, there's a newspaper headline that says, you know, local Bay Area covered in like web-like structures or something like that. And it's creepy, the feeling of realism in it.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those horror movies that gets a lot of time to breathe. You get a little bit more...
You see the characters' lives before they go to shit.
Donald Sutherland is like an FDA... Or
FDA inspector
FDA
kind
inspector
of person.
FDA inspector who definitely relishes in his job of making people...
Squirm a little bit. And he's got a bit of a thing that's like both friendship, but he'd like it to be more... with one of the scientists who analyzes, like, stuff from when they do samples.
Like salmonella.
For salmonella and things like that. And her husband is kind of a bit of a dude bro who...
He's a dentist.
There's a lot of elements in the story we saw about where people are talking to each other but aren't really connecting.
Yep.
And so, like, when she first goes home to her husband, he's got, like, his, like, soup, you know, the biggest TV of the 70s around. He's watching sports. And he's got, like, headphones more like we do now.
Yeah.
But we're just starting to potentially come into play in those days. And he's, like, she's talking to him and he's like, babe, hang on, I'm listening to the game, you know, and... that's why Donald Sutherland wants to take her away from that life.
But
he'll get his shot inadvertently.
In a way.
And then there's a few other people that come in. There's the pop psychiatrist author, who's like almost like the Dr. Phil of his era, as Leonard Nimoy.
Yep.
And then
doing a great job, by the way.
And a jealous writer who can't seem to get things published, who's Jeff Goldblum.
Yep. Whose character is married to from Alien.
Yeah, you remember the lady in Alien who freaked out the most throughout it and was like on the verge of crying and panicking throughout that?
Yep.
It's her. She freaks out a bit in this too.
She does.
But she's a good actress.
She's really good.
And it sort of weaves through some sort of 70s motifs about alienation and stuff as they start to realize that that loved ones are not themselves. It's pretty much the classic story, but pretty creepy.
Yeah, it's just a level of kind of like, you're getting a bunch of people saying that my husband or wife is acting different. They're not the same person. Leonard Nimoy is there kind of like, oh, you're just not doing... It's okay. It'll be...
I actually loved his sort of pop psychiatry thing. He's like, we have such a hard time connecting in this time with all... We've got so many distractions, and it's so easy to feel disconnected. Of course you feel like your husband's not who he was when you married him. We often feel that way.
But it's a group of outcasts going up against something that's insurmountable.
Right. You very quickly get the sense that this is way bigger than they could possibly handle. Yeah. That this is like in one night, it feels like half the city got taken over. And they've got to look for areas where they think things are sort of normal, but it is, it doesn't end super well.
No. It's kind of sad.
I mean, it does if you're on a certain side.
I mean,
that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point, Randy. Randy has given me he's given me the Sutherland point.
I will say this. This was back when Sutherland was like headlining movies. Yeah. Like he was like the go-getter. He's really good in this.
He is. He is. You know, there's a scene in it where the girl who he would like to hook up with shows up at his place and he's cooking.
Yep.
And she's like literally like 2 feet from him talking and he's like, go ahead, tell me what's going on. And she's talking while he cooks. And it's one of those scenes that's supposed to show that they're kind of not really looking each other in the eyes and connecting.
Yeah, well,
is actually listening to her.
He is, but he's also talking about like the cooking as well, and they're kind of talking well over each other. Yeah,
it's really well done.
Everything in this, like cinematography, pacing, music, it all kind of coalesces into this fantastic movie.
It's funny how 70s it feels, though.
Yeah.
There's like the 70s pop psychology. Mm-hmm. There's a place where it's like a place where people go to have mud baths, like a sauna sort of thing.
I wouldn't go to that place, by the way. It looked a little sketchy.
It's seedy looking, yeah. But like Jeff Goldblum's girlfriend works there. And that is where they find the first like grizzly pod person body, which this movie has a little bit of gore in it.
It does.
Not a ton, but a little bit.
Also, don't sleep.
That's
when they get you.
You might be a homeless man with a dog, and the pods incorrectly fuse you to your dog.
Yep.
That was weird. I'd forgotten that.
So now let's talk about its sort of follow-through conceptually in Us. Jordan Peele's Us. That was his second movie. And this one's a story about a pretty suburban-type family.
Yeah.
Headlined by Winston
Duke and Lupita Nyong'o.
Yep. Lupita Nyong'o, yep. And they have a young son and a daughter who's like, I don't know, 12, 15, something.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I think she's closer. I think she's close to the age of 12.
Yeah. And they're off on a vacation, but the mom has some traumatic experiences with the beach and the boardwalk where they're going. And there's flashbacks throughout that will give you little hints and things of what happened in that.
Is it Santa Cruz?
I think it is. I couldn't remember if it was an invented one or not.
Yeah.
But, and in fact, we will see that as a kid, she wandered off from her slightly inattentive parents.
Yep.
And that felt, by the way, like very much an Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of
thing. It did.
That's the very opening of the movie.
Yep, it's her and her dad, played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
I forgot this
was. And kind of enjoying the boardwalk.
She sneaks into like a fun house that's probably closed.
I believe it's Merlin's Forest or something.
Something like that. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Find Yourself is what it subtitled.
And it has aspects of, you know, the usual things that pop out and scare you, as well as a mirror maze and stuff like that. And in there, she, in addition to seeing reflections of herself, at one point you see what she looks like, her backing into a reflection, only it's another actual human kid, dressed like her, looking like her, and then the movie cuts away, and you're like, oh, this was, something happened.
Yeah.
And
But then we get a family on vacation.
Then you get a family on vacation, and a lot of times they're a normal family with a lot of, honestly, very funny interactions. He is one of the most dads of them all.
He's he is so good at just being a normal guy.
He buys or rents, or does he actually buy the cheesy boat, which is named
he bought it
Crawdaddy.
Yeah, he bought Crawdaddy and he bought it for cheap.
Yes. And
but it's all like the interactions, the kid playing in the closet, getting locked in, the daughter who's obsessed with her, like, being on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
The scene in the car trying to get in rhythm with the... What song is it?
Five on it.
Yep.
It's those simple things that kind of just, like, oh, you know this family. You can relate to that interaction in such a way.
But then there comes a point when the X Factor is introduced to it, and the mom has already, like, been weird. Like, I'm not comfortable here. I'd kind of like to go home. And then one of the kids says, hey, there's a family standing out in our driveway.
She outright tells her husband, like, I was here, like, for the first time reveals the whole traumatizing thing about being lost.
She doesn't tell him everything.
Not everything, but more than he apparently is. She's told him.
And he's a little bit like, oh, I'm like...
How did you keep this bottled up?
He's fairly supportive. You know, he's like, oh, this is a lot you've been carrying around. But he's also a little clueless
and then then the son comes in and there's a family outside.
They're just standing there, like, at the end of the driveway in silhouette.
Yep.
Almost like, you know, the kind of, like, stickers on the back of the car kind of family. You know, mom, dad, and kids.
They're holding hands.
Yep. And shortly thereafter, he tries to put on a front. He I can only say he puts on his street voice.
Yes.
And it's hilarious. He's like, you know, he's like, we're going to have some trouble here or whatever. And he threatens them. And then they, like, scatter.
Well, he goes to get the bat and does it a second time. And then they scatter. And he's like, oh, shit.
And it's like, then they are almost animalistically trying to get in the house. Yeah. And, you know, we don't need to talk through the whole plot, but once they get in, there's a confrontation and a sort of, it is home invasion-y.
Oh, it is.
And then they, and they're, like, looking at them, and they're like, the kid says they're us. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they're like these scarred, some cases burned, weird, animalistic, bizarro versions of them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And they are trying to figure it out. They're all wearing these weird, like, red jumpsuits. And they use scissors.
And a glove, like a single glove.
Yep.
I don't know how Lupita Nyong'o wasn't nominated for something about this. Because
they don't nominate horror movies.
But it's true. She is so freaking good playing two different characters.
Yeah.
I mean, they all play two
with
different characters.
With super scary voice from her. The version that they would call, like, the tethered version. As you find out more about these weird underground community that may have... It may be, like, everybody has a duplicate down there. Mm-hmm.
Do you think this idea terrified Jordan Peele as a kid? Like, that there's all of these tunnels and stuff?
Yeah, I think, like, his imagination started working and imagining what could be going on.
Like, why do these things exist when no one uses them? Or there's abandoned subway tunnels and things like that?
Right, the movie opens with a quote about how there's, like, you know, tens of thousands or millions of miles of you know, unused tunnels and abandoned tunnels and stuff like that throughout America. And there's symbolism in there. You can easily see this is like, oh, this is an underclass of sorts. Mm. It's not even known about, though. Right. And yet they have connections to the people up above. And you will see them sometimes. You know, they're more animalistic. They eat rabbits, and they're weird. You'll see people upstairs, like at the amusement park where they're on a roller coaster, and their, like, duplicates are down below them, and they just kind of, like, hold up their arms, like, roller coaster style, and they're like, ah,
but they're in, like, secret...
As if they were on it, but they're not really moving. They're just, like, acting like they're on a roller coaster. Yeah. It's so... Some of those scenes are intensely creepy, and this movie has, like, a high scare factor.
It's also super weird as a concept. Like when they introduced in the trailer, I remember, like... It's like, oh, it's like a doppelganger family. That's interesting. That's scary. And then it gets bigger and bigger.
Yes. You don't realize that this is, in a way, does fulfill the original idea of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. First time people watching that, they don't realize that this is anything more than a few people.
Right.
And in fact, it is like initially just the whole town, and then it's like, oh, is this the world?
Because then after that home invasion, where the Elizabeth Moss invasion, she comes in for like 5 minutes and kills it with that weird kind of montage in front of a mirror, like her doppelganger putting on lipstick, just all the facial.
That 15 or 20 minute sequence in overall and deal in that house is somehow some of the darkest stuff and also some of the funniest stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan Peele, what I like is he didn't do the thing where it's like there's a serious moment and you have to throw in some humor because you think it's going to be too uncomfortable to be that sincere. It's more like he's just like, you never quite know when there might be something weirdly funny.
Yep.
Like their equivalent of Siri inadvertently playing the wrong song.
Call the police.
While someone
you want fuck the police.
While someone is dying.
This kind of does ride the line of humor and horror and...
I mean, it leans more towards horror.
It does.
But there's no point at which there's not at least potentially something kind of funny about to be said.
Yeah.
And it has one of those endings that Nick is in its way as dark as
it is.
Snatchers. You don't know quite what's going to happen next, but like clearly a lot of people have already been killed. We don't know if it's like worldwide or what.
Well,
it could be.
I mean, it's Hands Across America, so at least it's all of America.
I mean, we know it's there, but are they, like, all killing? It kind of seems like they
it
are.
It seems like they all killed, basically, and then joined hands. Some of them probably failed. I just feel like the odds of survival of us is definitely higher than the survival rate of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
I, that's true.
You think?
I think you're almost 100% likely to get killed in Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
You know,
you could kill your doppelganger.
But I think the only reason why they kind of are our leads lucked out is because of the big reveals that we will have, and that there's a particularly strange relationship between the girl and or the grown now grown mom and Red her doppelganger. And, I think that threw things off.
I think you could be right. I'm just saying that there's the potential. You're not being dissolved into a web-like thing and desiccated husk and replaced.
Yes.
You're just getting killed.
That's true. The aliens do seem to have more resources in, or like...
I mean, they were putting pods on ships, man. There was no...
Do you think there's any version where Jordan Peele showed, like, a montage of, like, people dead everywhere?
Probably. I mean, we got all on the pier, on the boardwalk and stuff. We definitely saw the bodies there.
But I also
but there
I like
newscasts
movies.
Still going on.
Yeah, and I like movies that end without you knowing everything, especially in horror movies. The Thing is a good example of that. All the people who like endlessly try and figure out, well, what's the perfect way to figure out who was the thing at the end? I'm like, Carpenter has said in a billion interviews that's not the point. He wants it to be up in the air.
Yeah.
I'm like, stop trying to think it is like that. There's a riddle to solve. And enjoy ambiguity, you dumb fucks.
I think I'm just glad to have Jordan Peele. The movies he creates, the movies he creates, are insanely interesting.
Yeah. I realize they all have some roots in an existing genre. So I would say the sort of Step Brothers genre for Get Out, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers for this one, and I don't know, scary UFO stuff for the third one.
Yeah.
But at no point does he ever feel like he's repeating anything but like any past tropes. Not even like the premise usually like looks like it on the surface but ends up being so different.
Yeah.
He's one of the great voices in horror. We're lucky to have him, and he's like an always see in the theater for me.
And you said that Us went up in your estimation when you watched it last night.
It did. I think it's still like Get Out is still the top. I think it just comes together so well that it's hard to beat that.
Yeah.
But Us was like, I was like, man, this is just a really well-made movie. There is no wasted space. Even the conversations, they're all revealing something about the characters or giving you some bit of information you didn't have before. And this is not to knock Nope, which is a great movie.
Yes.
I'm the odd man out. I think Nope is his best.
That's your favorite.
His best, really.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to revisiting it sometime. I'm not sure, you know, whether next year probably, and see where I land on it, because I know that I'll just kind of enjoy different parts and just, like, watching little scenes here and there.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up there. I'll come back. Next week I'll talk about Spider-Man 2, because I just started playing it.
Okay, fair enough.
You haven't burned through it like
really
some people have?
Much. No, some people are done. But we'll wrap it up there, and we'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Drew.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.